From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Я бы не хотел говорить про коммунизм.
I don't want to talk about communism here.
That was the late president of the Russian Federation, Boris Yeltsin, 29 years ago this month. In September of 1989, he was a member then of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, speaking at John Hopkins University on the future of Soviet democracy.
Какого числа и какого месяца и года он наступит в СССР?
I don't want to try to tell you what year or what day and what time of the day communism will finally be realized in the USSR.
Имею в виду, что это просто идея заоблачная, о которой можно мечтать, рассуждать, но не реализовать.
Bearing in mind, as we now know, that communism is really just an idea, sort of pie in the sky, which we should think about and keep our eyes on, but we shouldn't try to implement it here on Earth.
Again, that was the late Russian President Boris Yeltsin, September of 1990 at John Hopkins University here in the United States, discussing the future of Soviet democracy. In May of the following year, Yeltsin would become the president of the Supreme Soviet and begin a process that led by December of 1991 to the dissolution of the USSR, thereby terminating any opportunity to democratize it. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Luciana Bone. We heard from Boris Yeltsin. He offered his view of communism as being something pie in the sky. Let's not actually try to use that as policy. That's basically what he was saying. This is, 72 years after the October Revolution.
Right. Yep. during which, we never forget, Russia was industrialized in 10 years between 1930 and 1940.
Yeah, twice, actually, because after being devastated in World War II, they industrialized again, like 1945 to 1950.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I have plenty of little drastic statistics of what happened when Mr. Yeltsin actually got his hands on the state, the Russian
right.
state,
yeah.
In 1991. So just one thing to say to begin with. I want to answer him and say that in the transition from a collectivized to a privatized economy, that's essentially what he did, between 1991 and 1994, the Russian population lost nearly 5 years of life expectancy. That's just a little detail. So, but I think that the, you know, Putin said that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest catastrophes of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And indeed it was. And I want to say that the Soviet Union made in the 1990s a tragic mistake, one that China, Vietnam, Laos, for example, did not make. So in China, Vietnam, Laos, the leadership effected economic market reforms, sort of, what is it, market socialism is called?
Yeah, right.
They did effect these reforms in the 80s and 90s, but they didn't change the political structure and the ideological character of the state. Their constitution kept the Marxist-Leninist ideology, and instituted a program of the road to socialism and eventual communism, and kept intact the Communist Party as the leadership as having the reader, you know, as the leadership of the state. Now, in the Soviet Union, what happened was that the political structures that had been the Soviet Union were dismantled. That means they killed all that the Bolshevik Revolution had built. And in fact, we heard Yeltsin saying, let's not talk about communism. Communism was just an idea, just a pie in the sky. So they killed the Communist Party, the Politburo, the Supreme Soviet, the Economic State Planning Institution, and replaced all by Western-style parliamentary democracy with a so-called multi-party structure, which is, of course...
It's a bourgeois party with many faces. It's a bourgeois party with multiple marketing faces replacing the Workers' Party.
Yeah. Eventually, we have the Russian Communist Party, which is a reformed party. This Western-style parliamentary democracy imposed a rapid, as we know, rapid and radical change. From the collectivized economy, from the socialized economy, socialist economy, to market economy. And it adapted shock therapy. It's important to see how this political, how the destruction of the political system occurred in 1991 under Yeltsin's rule, you know, direction. And so... the year 1991 saw the abolition of the Communist Party, the introduction of a market economy, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And just to recap what we said very briefly, just the crucial months of 1991, in August 24th, Yeltsin transferred the archives of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to the authorities of the state archives of the state of Russia. On August 24th, Mikhail Gorbachev created the Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Economy. This is all before the dissolution in December. Right. On August 25th, Yeltsin nationalized the properties of the Communist Party's Soviet Union in Russia, including not only party offices, but also educational institutions, hotels, everything. And on November 30th, Yeltsin ended the activity of the Communist Party Soviet Union in Russia. And then on November 1st began the radical economic reforms. You see where I'm getting there, that they are in order to actually implement this radical reform, they had to dismantle the whole state architecture. Now we come to the last act, which is 8 December 1991, and we talk about the Belavezha Accord, which was effected the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And it said, this Belavezha Accord said, the USSR as a subject of international law and a geopolitical reality is ceasing its existence. Very, very thought about phrases. Subject of international law, it's not longer, and geopolitical reality is out. Right. Now, what is terrible about this is that the presidents of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus were the only three who signed this dissolution of the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin, Leonid Kravchuk, and Stanislav Shushkevich met in the nature reserve of Belaveshkaya Pushka. They declared the dissolution of the Soviet Union. They established a sort of interim name for it, the Commonwealth of Independent States. The agreement was made despite the fact, as we always mention, that in March of that year, the population voted 78% overall to keep and conserve the Soviet Union. Now, the signing of the treaty was communicated by telephone first to President Bush in the United States by Yeltsin, and second by Shushkevich to Michael Gorbachev.
Right. They told Bush before they told Gorbachev.
Yeah, yeah. And you could see this is three republics of the Soviet Union right. signed an agreement to dissolve it. There's absolutely no right. legality in this. There's no consultation with the people.
Right.
And this is how it was done.
Yeah, actually it was done in opposition to a consultation, to the outcome of a consultation with the people. The people had their say in March. The people overwhelmingly said, keep the Soviet Union, and these, you know, Molary and Shempovich show up in a room somewhere and decide to change the situation to their liking anyway. And you left just one thing out I wanted to mention in the list of things that you listed, which we hit last time, was after August, the so-called coup attempt, in September, one of the first things that they did was to privatize the Ministry of Fuel and Energy into Rosneftgaz. In other words, the oil and gas reserves of the people of the Soviet Union that were being administered by the Ministry of Fuel and Energy were privatized. This is months before the Soviet Union was dissolved. It was by the Soviet government under Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember. Yes. That's right. And later they kept price control on that, unlike any other aspect of the economy.
Right.
Well, so we talk about the, we come to talk about the actual shock therapy here.
Jeffrey Sachs.
Sorry, what?
Jeffrey Sachs.
Jeffrey Sachs. Yeah. Larry Summers,
Igor Gaidar, Anatoly Chubais, the whole group.
Yeah. Well, so, but already, excuse me about the voice, but already in, so the reform started in November, that is, actually in October 1991, 2 months before the official dissolution of the Soviet Union, Yeltsin and his advisors, including the reform economist, neoliberal economist Yegor Gaidar, who became Yeltsin's, I think, economic minister or something in the ministry. He was sacked in 1994, and is now somewhere within the American sphere of think tanks, etc.
Or tending bar
anyway,
somewhere.
Sorry, what?
We're tending bar somewhere. I'm sure you had plenty of experience with Yeltsin doing that.
So they, in October, established a program of radical economic reforms through shock therapy. But in reality, you know, I mean, it was a confederation of bureaucrats, gangsters, politicians, and they just seized and privatized the most profitable wings of the Soviet Union's economy. And as you pointed out, the first thing they did,
grab the
oil, their hands on the oil and the energy industry, which Putin has been collecting back.
That's right. That's his big. That's Putin's big sin. Is that the people, so here you go. You have somewhere in a back room, somewhere in a cave, God knows where, maybe it's next to Bin Laden's cave. All the characters that really run the world, that own everything, have their annual or weekly or whatever meeting, and they all sit around. So who are you? I'm Bill Gates. I own, you know, this software thing, and I'm so-and-so. I own Apple. And who are you? I own Russian oil and gas supplies. That's the richest guy in the room, okay?
Yes,
and all of a sudden,
that
was the wealth of the Soviet peoples, and suddenly it belonged to a couple of guys who were allowed to do what they want with it. And Putin's big sin was to pull them back in and say, maybe you'll be allowed to continue to own this and make some money on it, but the goals of this enterprise are subordinated to the Russian national interest. This is a national security issue, and this wealth of the Russian people will be used to help build Russia. And that is his big offense in the eyes of the world.
Yeah. And in effect, if you look at what Putin did, is another reconstruction of the psychology and part of the economy of the Soviet Union after this devastation of shock therapy and
They looted
Russia the way they treated Greece.
You know,
there are different mechanisms, but it's the same thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, they looted it. That's what they do. It's, you know, there's like the Mel Brooks movies have like Engulf and Devour Corporation. You know, that's what they do. You have two models in the world. The U.S. goes in and they basically bring guns, point them at everybody, say, go get your stuff and bring it to my boat. No, I'm not building you a road. Go get your stuff and bring it to my boat or we'll kill you and your family. Well, let's kill your family first just to give you some motivation. That's the U.S. model. China has a different model. Hey, you know what? We want some of your stuff. Let's build you a factory. You can sell some cars. You can just give us some of the stuff. We'll give you gas or whatever and blah, blah, blah. Win-win. Those are the two models. The model, the short version, the short language version for the Western model, which is imperialism, that's really the, you know, the economic and political condition we're talking about, is looting. That's what they do. They loot.
Yep, that's exactly right. And so, shock therapy, of course, was first tried in Chile. And it's an economic term, and it refers to the sudden release of price and currency controls, withdrawal of state subsidies, and immediate trade liberalization within a country, including large-scale privatization of previously public-owned assets. So what did Yeltsin do? What did this amount? Well, large state-owned industries were put up for sale at throwaway prices. And this was called the largest garage sale in history.
Right.
Collective farms were removed with no food, leaving no food security. Foreign trade was liberalized significantly, radically, and the list of Russia's trading partners became dominated by Western European rather than East European and former Soviet countries. The old system of social welfare was destroyed, and the governance stopped all subsidies. Overnight, pensioners lost money that was expected to see them through their old age. Professors and military officers, people who would have had good lives in the Soviet system, you know, now earn pitifully small salaries.
Right.
And particularly hard hit were people who went to work in Siberia, the Far East, the Russian Arctic, and they went there for triple wages and suddenly found themselves with no savings and not enough food to feed themselves and their families. There were even reports of unpaid workers collapsing in the streets from hunger and people freezing to death because they couldn't afford to heat their homes.
Right.
The middle section of the society suffered, of course, professors, teachers, etc. But those who were educated either migrated to different countries or simply fell apart, disintegrated. The new mafia emerged. Of course, Yeltsin's family mafia was one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like in fascist situation in Latin America, backed by economic, they enforced economic activities by force. You know, privatization widened, of course, the gap between rich and poor. So when in January 1992, the government ended price controls, the result was 2,520% inflation in 1992. The first year of economic reform. Ordinary Russians saw their savings vaporized, their salaries crash, and the cost of ordinary items, like eggs and chickens, cost a month's salary. So when state controls were lifted, the prices for basic foods like bread and butter shot up as much as 500% in a matter of days. The inflation rate was higher than 100% a month. It was 245% in 1992. This was a social devastation.
Yeah, also, the privatization, when they were essentially, I mean, you were talking about gangster capitalism, basically. The first, from the time of the creation of the Soviet Union, the Soviet economy was locked out of the West and the parts of Asia that were controlled by the West, which have up until the late 40s was most of Asia and still remains a substantial part of Asia. Among the other problems that is presented for Soviet economy, the currency was rejected by the West. They wouldn't take Soviet currency, rubles, for Western goods. So they had to do all kinds of barter arrangements and things when they finally started to engage. And what that meant,
like Cuba.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and what that meant on the ground in the USSR was, as these some of these businesses were privatized and shut down, and so now you had to import food, for example, the currency that the average working person had to work with was basically worthless, and so they and the banking system that grew up within the Soviet sphere was completely rejected, and it was eliminated in favor of, in essence, I mean, there were official structures that remained and ended up being converted, but what you had happen was gangster capitalism in the form of black marketeers and money launderers acquiring capital and ending up being the junior partners of Western capital, setting up a financial sector in Russia. And so the whole purchasing power and the banking and the exchange and all of the things that deal with finance in Russia were built on the back of a mafia, essentially, or a mafia construct, and that was easily controlled by a small group of people inside Russia, and really was developed to be subservient to Western capital, Western finance capital.
Right. There were no structures in place that could sustain a market economy, that could go directly from it, and this facilitated the gangster. There were no legal institutions, no.
Right.
There was no architecture that could sustain, all of a sudden, a market economy of the kind.
Right.
So it was just plain looting. So the shock therapy strategy was devised by Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs. And it was supported by Larry Summers, the U.S. Undersecretary of the Treasury in charge of international affairs. Sachs had already developed an economic strategy for Poland and then was asked to do the same thing for Russia. So what Sachs and Summers did was encourage the United States to push the IMF and the World Bank to lend Russia tens of billions of dollars to prop up the ruble.
Right.
So where before it wasn't even, in the geography, financial geography of the West. So now prop it up so it could be internationally convertible and attract investment and, in their view, kickstart the economy. Oh, I hate that word. Their economy, it's nothing to do. So, of course, these economic reformers were branded as good guys by the United States, the West in general. And as we mentioned, Gaidar was the architect of Yeltsin's original economic plan way back in October. And then just these international lenders, just hear the title they have, the international lenders such as the International Monetary Fund, well, we're familiar with that, but the Paris Club of Western government lenders. Who are they? And the London Club of International Commercial Banks. These are people who gather in rooms.
Right.
I mean, and they plot. They provided substantial aid, and with the proviso that Russia must improve economic indicators, and such as its inflation rate and budget deficits. In other words, the same thing that is done to Burkina Faso, that is required Venezuela to do, that's what a regime change in Venezuela would do.
Right.
It was done in Russia, and these idiots expected this great old country that has gone through all kinds of massive tragedies and historical trauma, they expected it to become Burkina Faso.
Right, that's right. That was the goal. You know, there's a contemporary example of that right now in South America, several, but one is most glaring, Argentina, where,
yes,
you know, 20 years ago, you had a complete and total economic catastrophe there.
In 2000, yes.
Okay, and then Nestor Kirchner, a couple of terms of him and a term and a half, I think, of his wife, they turned the country around completely, you know, using leftist, you know, liberal economics, mm-hmm, at least, not mm-hmm neoliberal, but actual, like, you know, Keynesian economics and some social,
yeah,
plan, you know, some socialist planning. And
yeah,
Macri gets elected in December of 2015, and, you know, like less than 3 years later,
yeah,
they have brought Argentina right back to the same place where,
yes,
the IMF,
yes,
is now.
And I understand now, yep, yep, there's a complete general strike in Argentina.
That's,
you're
right,
up to date with that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's you know, basically what they did was impose the same neoliberal program on the Argentinian,
yeah,
economy almost immediately after he got elected in December of 2015. And
immediately.
It took less than,
yeah,
3 years,
like,
to devastate the economy.
Yeah, yeah, and a flight of capital.
Yep.
And the 2000 was tragic because I was in Italy in 2000 in December when Argentina went belly up and the people were in the street screaming, ya basta. You know, that was just go, everybody get out.
Right.
They threw everybody out, defaulted on the debt. And, of course, Argentina and Italy are highly connected. I,
yes,
mean, it's just like a... Because so many Italians,
yep,
if you look at the names,
for sure,
so many Argentinians are from from Italy.
Yes.
So there was a great deal of sympathy, and so I remember it very well. But now to see it go back is just amazing. They keep coming back. They never give up.
I know it.
So, well, of course, to return to the economic, what I call the economic genocide or the tsunami of shock therapy.
Yeah.
In the course of Yeltsin's era, per capita income fell by about 75%, and the nation's population fell by more than 2 million, due largely to the steep decline in public health, what Stalin had built.
That's right. And by the way, that's on a base in, this is now the Russian Republic, that's on a base of about 150 million people. So you're talking, you know, about 1.35% roughly or something, 1 1/3% of the,
yeah,
whole population.
Yeah, but it's more, this estimate was then revised in 2009 by the Lancet. I'll get to that, I hope.
All I'm saying is one in 100 people died. One in 100, more, even more than that, like 1.5 in 100 died. And so
the state industry, of course, collapsed because, and this has happened all over the Balkans as well,
right,
all over Eastern Europe.
Look at Ukraine.
Many people lost their jobs.
Yep, and
were
not
paid.
Yep, look at Ukraine. Ukraine is still suffering from this now. Luciana, thank you very much, and we'll pick it up here next week.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.